This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. At least 22 migrants have died and dozens more remain missing after two boats packed with more than 140 refugees capsized in separate incidents in Greece. These sinkings are the deadliest in recent years, and the tragedies add to rising tensions between NATO allies Greece and Turkey. Anthe Karasava reports from Athens.
Shipwrecked migrants climbing up a craggy cliff on the island of Kythnos in southeast Greece, hanging onto rocks as furious waves batter dozens more beneath them on the shores. Mayor Stratos Charchalakis described the tragedy as he scrambled to the site with rescue crews. It was terrible, he says. I alone saw five people drowning before me. The weather conditions were fierce. The smuggling vessel broke in half from the collision. Authorities say they managed to save 80 of the estimated 95 migrants on a sailboat. Similar searches were ongoing off the coast of Lesbos, on the easternmost rim of Greece, where 16 migrant women and a baby boy died when the flimsy rubber raft they were crammed into crashed on a rocky tip off the island's shores. Antikarasava for VOA News, Athens.
Authorities are still investigating a motive for the deadliest mass shooting in Thailand carried out by one person. At least 38 people, including 24 children, were killed in a knife and gun attack at a child center in northern Thailand. Authorities identified the gunman as Panya Kamrab, an ex-police officer who was fired from the force last year because he was involved in drug trafficking. This is VOA News. The U.S. military said it carried out an airstrike on Thursday in northern Syria that killed two Islamic State members, including a leader it named as Abu Hashim al-Yumawi. The strike came just hours after a rare U.S. helicopter raid on a government-held village in Syria's northeast killed another Islamic State official. As with the helicopter raid, the U.S. Military Central Command said initial assessments indicated no civilian casualties, and it said there were no U.S. military casualties. The 47-member U.N. Human Rights Council has rejected a resolution to hold a debate next year on alleged human rights abuses in Xinjiang by a narrow margin. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The vote was preceded by a vigorous debate in which several member states presented their positions for and against the draft resolution. The United States, one of 10 Western sponsors, introduced the resolution. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Human Rights Council, Michelle Taylor, noted that evidence of human rights violations in China's Xinjiang province was recorded in a U.N. report published more than a month ago. The report was issued on August 31st by former U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet. It documents credible evidence of torture or other ill treatment and sexual and gender-based violence against the Uyghur minority. The report says the violations may constitute crimes against humanity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
President Biden has taken a dramatic step toward decriminalizing marijuana. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the story.
The president is pardoning thousands of Americans convicted of simple possession of marijuana and is calling on governors to follow suit for state offenses. In a written statement, the president says nobody should be in jail just for using or possessing marijuana. He says there are thousands who have prior federal marijuana possession convictions who, as a result, may be denied jobs, housing, or other things. He says the pardons will help relieve the collateral consequences. He's ordering administration officials to review how marijuana is scheduled under federal law. Sagar Magani, Washington.
The Biden administration will begin redirecting U.S.-bound travelers who had been to Uganda within the previous 21 days to five major American airports to be screened for Ebola, as public health officials sent an alert to health care workers. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Today is Friday, October 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, tensions rise in the Korean Peninsula as Pyongyang fires more missiles and Seoul scrambles dozens of fighter jets in response.
The highly unusual incident has come just hours after North Korea fired two ballistic missiles into the sea. The North's warplanes consisted of 8 fighter jets and 4 bombers.
70 migrants die and dozens remain missing after 2 boats packed with refugees sink in Greece.
Shipwrecked migrants flying up a craggy cliff on the island of Kythnos in southeast Greece, hanging onto rocks as furious waves batter dozens more beneath them on the shores.
And a former police officer kills dozens of preschoolers and teachers in Thailand. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Tensions have escalated on the Korean Peninsula, this after North Korea flew 12 warplanes near its border with South Korea, and the South reacted by scrambling 30 military planes. Earlier, Pyongyang fired 2 short ballistic missiles into the sea on Thursday in the direction of Japan after the return of U.S. aircraft carrier to the region and a U.N. Security Council meeting in response to the North's recent launches, Associated Press correspondent Karine Chamas reports.
A highly unusual incident has come just hours after North Korea fired 2 ballistic missiles into the sea. The North's warplanes consisted of 8 fighter jets and 4 bombers, which flew in formation by the border. South Korean officials believe they conducted air-to-surface firing drills. South Korea responded with 30 fighter jets and other warplanes of their own, though they didn't engage in any clash with the North Korean aircraft. I'm Karine Chamas.
Amid unconfirmed report that a train operated by Russia's nuclear division was spotted heading towards Ukraine, the White House says that it has no indication that the Kremlin is preparing to use nuclear weapons against the country. Nuclear weapons experts tell VOA if Russia is moving nuclear weapons towards the Ukrainian border, the United States will know. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
Russia has the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons in the world, and experts say it holds 10 times more tactical nuclear weapons than the United States. In March 2018, Russian President Vladimir Putin unveiled an array of new weapons, saying they could hit almost any point in the world and not be intercepted. Now that Putin is suffering military losses in Ukraine, he has threatened to use any means at his disposal to defend Russia. On Tuesday, the White House responded to unconfirmed reports that Russia may be moving nuclear weapons toward the border with Ukraine. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
We take any nuclear weapons or nuclear saber rattling very seriously here. But I do want to say, we have not seen any reason to adjust our own strategic nuclear posture, nor do we have indication that Russia is preparing to imminently use nuclear weapons.
In the face of military losses, Russia announced a mobilization that has caused hundreds of thousands of Russians to flee the country. National security expert Mitchell Wallerstein says if Putin were to use nuclear weapons, he would break a long-time taboo. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
Were he to do so, this would be crossing a red line that no country has crossed since World War II. And the concern is that as he is increasingly cornered and finds that he has limited options, that he might try to use a small tactical nuclear weapon, much smaller probably than the ones that were used in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, either to try to decapitate the Ukraine regime in Kyiv, or to simply do a demonstration to say, look, this is what I can do.
Other experts are also concerned. James Acton is co-director of the Nuclear Policy Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
I think if this war goes in a very bad direction for Putin, I think if he's faced with a catastrophic military defeat, if his hold on power looks in jeopardy, if the Russian economy looks on the brink of collapse, then I can't rule out the possibility of Russia using nuclear weapons. I don't think it's that likely, but I think it's more likely now than at any time since the end of the Cold War, for sure.
Acton says he believes that, despite his bravado, Putin does not think he can use nuclear weapons to win the war against Ukraine.
The goal is to terrify Ukraine, its Western backers, the United States in particular, that the threat of further escalation, the threat of a even worse all-out nuclear war, could terrify them into backing down, into suing for peace, into making concessions, into giving Putin a face-saving way out.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky says his forces are making rapid gains, retaking dozens of villages in eastern and southern Ukraine. Russia's defense ministry has conceded that Russian forces have retreated in the face of Ukraine's counteroffensive. Nuclear experts tell VOA that were Putin to move nuclear weapons closer to Ukraine, the U.S. would know about it. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
Thank you, Cindy. At least 17 migrants have died and dozens more remain missing after two boats packed with more than 140 refugees capsized in separate incidents in Greece. The sinkings are the deadliest in recent years, and the tragedies add to rising tensions between NATO allies Greece and Turkey. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Shipwrecked migrants flying up a craggy cliff on the island of Kythnos in southeast Greece, hanging onto rocks as furious waves batter dozens more beneath them on the shores. Mayor Stratos Charchalakis described the tragedy as he scrambled to the site with rescue crews. It was terrible, he says. I alone saw five people drowning before me. The weather conditions were fierce. The smuggling vessel broke in half from the collision, and ferocious waves battered dozens of migrants as rescue crews tried to haul them out of the sea with cranes. Had they landed just 50 meters west or east of that point, Charchalakis said, they would have all been spared. Authorities say they managed to save 80 of the estimated 95 migrants on a sailboat. Nearly 20 of them were minors, but rescue crews aided by Air Force helicopters continued to scour the sea to locate more than a dozen believed missing. Similar searches were ongoing off the coast of Lesbos, on the easternmost rim of Greece, where 16 migrant women and a baby boy died when the flimsy rubber raft they were crammed into crashed on a rocky tip off the island's shores. 10 of the migrants were rescued and taken to a local hospital, while the bodies of the 17 women were taken to the island's morgue, and the rest of the estimated 40 who were in the rubber boat, mostly women and children, remain missing. Authorities say both boats originated from Turkey. No life vests were available on either boat, and neither was equipped with lifeboats. The tragedy among the worst of the so-called Mediterranean crossings migrants have used for decades to sneak into Europe has Greece lashing out at its rival neighboring Turkey, government spokesman Yannis Economou.
Τέτοια ανεύθυνη συμπεριφορά και ταυτόχρονα οι πλημέλειες της Τουρκίας, από τα παράλια της οποίας...
Turkey is clearly to blame for this human tragedy, he told reporters. And so long as it continues to turn a blind eye to human traffickers, making a mint out of migrant misery, it is mathematically certain that lives will continue to be lost. Economou and other senior government officials called on the European Union to pressure Turkey to uphold an agreement to block illegal inflows of migrants to the West. In exchange for millions of dollars in aid, it has received from Brussels to accommodate more than 3 million refugees there. Greece has faced increased migration traffic this year, a worrying uptick that many analysts here link to rising tensions between Athens and Ankara over energy rights in the seas that separate the two countries. Greece has rejected claims from rights groups that asylum seekers are being illegally pushed back to Turkey without being allowed to lodge asylum claims. And Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan last month accused Turkey of waging what he called oppressive policies, turning the Aegean Sea into a graveyard. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
Ethiopia's nearly 2-year civil war with Tigrayan forces may finally see peace talks after both sides agreed to an African Union-mediated dialogue in South Africa this weekend. The talks would come after a series of airstrikes in Tigray, including one on Thursday, and aid workers say killed more than 50 people when it hit a school sheltering war-displaced people. Fred Hartai in Addis Ababa has this report.
There have been reports of heavy fighting since hostilities resumed in late August between Ethiopia's federal government and the country's Tigray rebels, with dozens of civilians dying in airstrikes. This latest round of fighting has also seen Eritrea renew its involvement in the conflict on the side of Ethiopia's federal military, with the Tigray leadership saying Eritrea has launched a full-scale offensive into northern Tigray. Now, both the Tigray authorities and the federal government say they are ready to attend peace talks this weekend in South Africa, sponsored by the African Union, or AU. According to the AU Commission, the talks will be led by AU Special Envoy Olusegun Obasanjo, who will be supported by former South African Deputy President Phumzile Mlambo Ngcuka and former Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. However, the Tigray leadership has requested more information regarding the structure of the talks before attending them. They have long criticised Obasanjo's role as mediator, seeing him as too close to the Ethiopian Prime Minister, and have insisted that international officials participate in ceasefire discussions as observers and guarantors. Ahmed Solomon, a researcher at the Chatham House think tank in London, says there are credibility questions hanging over Obasanjo as mediator, but he adds that the talks could lead to a breakthrough.
If these talks proceed in the next couple of days, there'll be the first formal face-to-face direct talks between the conflict parties. And in that regard, there's a huge opportunity to reset this mediation and to try to begin building some confidence. Whether the opportunity is seized, of course, is another matter entirely. We've seen previous efforts not be successful. But I think what should be apparent, what should be key to this, is the seriousness of African partners, international community, to resolve this conflict.
The Tigray leadership has insisted on four demands as part of any agreement to end the fighting. These are unfettered humanitarian access to Tigray, the withdrawal of Eritrean troops, the restoration of Tigray's communication and banking services, and the return of territory lost in the conflicts. A previous round of informal talks held in Djibouti last month broke up without an agreement after federal officials failed to give guarantees on the restoration of Tigray's services, which had been shut down for more than a year. Solomon said the South Africa talks, if they take place, will not settle these issues, but they could kickstart a longer political process that does.
And that needs to be communicated through this process as a longer-term process towards ending the conflict, not just a one-time meeting. These talks should be seen as a stepping stone, not an end goal, not to achieve the ambition of ending the conflict, because that they won't do.
Will Davison, an analyst with the International Crisis Group, says the talks are likely to discuss procedural issues rather than thorny substantive issues. Fred Harter for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
In other news, a former police officer facing a drug charge burst into a daycare center in Thailand, killing dozens of preschoolers and teachers, and then shooting more people as he fled. At least 36 people were killed Thursday in the deadliest rampage in the nation's history. The assailant, who was fired earlier this year, took his own life after killing his wife and child at home. The attack took place in the rural province of Nongbulampu in northeastern Thailand, in one of the country's poorest regions. A witness said the assailant shot his way in. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofo in Washington. Inspired by protests in neighboring Iran, women in Afghanistan took to the streets after a suicide bombing at an educational center in Kabul killed dozens of people, most of them schoolgirls. Nazrana Ghaffar Yousai reports.
Afghan women protesting on the streets demanding better security and the right to education. The latest protest in Afghanistan began after last week's suicide attack on an education center in Kabul that killed more than 50 people, most of them schoolgirls. The attack took place in the western part of the city, home to a Hazara Shia community targeted by extremist groups in the past few years. Protesters say they are raising their voice to seek justice for the attack victims and the reopening of girls' secondary schools. This is not the first time Afghan women have protested for their rights after the Taliban took over and imposed repressive measures against women. 36-year-old Afghan activist who has taken part in women's protests in Kabul says that all too often they protest alone. The recent protest by Afghan women follow widespread protest in neighboring Iran over the September death of a woman who was detained by the country's morality police. However, the Afghan protests are smaller and limited only to a few cities. Iranian journalist and activist Soraya Leni says that it's because women in Iran have long enjoyed wider support.
But men are definitely out in the streets with women, and I think traditionally in Iran there is a history of men and women protesting together.
But there are parallels between the two countries.
One of the things that's so striking in both countries is the courage of these protesters who are willing to literally risk death to be heard and to fight back against this type of oppression.
Bar says that women in both countries are facing regimes demonstrating willingness to enforce the subjugation of women through really extreme forms of violence. Nazrana Yousafzai, VOA News, Washington.
UNICEF says the cholera outbreak in Syria has reached more than 100,000 patients and claimed the lives of 39 people, according to the Syrian Ministry of Health. For VOA, Muneb Taib has this report from Idlib, Syria, with Heda Murdoch in Istanbul.
In less than a month, cholera, a deadly waterborne disease, has reached nearly all of Syria's governorates and infected more than 10,000 people, according to UNICEF. And millions of people living in makeshift camps across the country's war-torn north are increasingly at risk. Clean water and basic sanitation can prevent cholera outbreaks, and the disease is treatable. Untreated, however, it can kill within hours. By Thursday, the death toll had climbed to at least 39. The Syrian Ministry of Health says most of the deaths involved patients who had delayed treatment or had chronic pre-existing conditions. UNICEF says that war, energy shortages, and drought have left nearly half of all Syrians reliant on alternative and often unsafe water sources. The agency says much of the nation's water infrastructure has been destroyed and most of its sewage is left untreated. Here in Idlib province, the last part of Syria still at war with the government, cholera cases have not been as widespread, but residents and aid workers say an outbreak in this war-torn area could quickly grow out of control. Roughly half the 4 million residents of Idlib are essentially homeless, living in crowded camps for displaced families. Most people here rely on humanitarian aid for their basic needs. The United Nations has called the outbreak a serious threat to Syria and the region, and has called for swift international action. The World Health Organization says that cholera cases worldwide have surged this year, with 26 countries reporting outbreaks. Experts say besides war and climate change, cholera, like many deadly diseases, is inextricably linked to extreme poverty. For Munib Taim in Idlib, Syria, Heather Murdoch, VOA News.
We're bringing women's voices to the conversation on things that matter to hearts and minds of women.
Here in Kinshasa, campaigns to raise awareness against the spread of coronavirus are common, but getting that information to people who have no access to water, electricity, or money can be a challenge.
With strong opinions and expertise on things that impact and change their lives.
I think a big thing for me is just being able to say that when these protests are happening, does it turn around into policy?
From right here in the nation's capital to on the ground from all over the African continent.
It really was powerful because it showed what is possible when men and women band together and say enough is enough.
We hear your voices, women's voices, our voices, and add your voice to the conversation. Each week, right here on The Voice of America, on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel. It's been 30 years since the signing of the Rome General Accord, which ended the civil war in Mozambique. So what does the country have to show for it? Despite discovering the second largest gas field in the world in Cabo Delgado, unaddressed local grievances and unequal distribution of resources have helped fuel an insurrection. Two experts discuss the state of play in Mozambique. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday, join us as we put the latest developments into a global context with stories, interviews, and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
This has been an international edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Chinedwafa in Washington. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Of the many atrocities committed during Putin's full-scale war against Ukraine, some of the most grievous relate to Russia's filtration operations. Filtration is the anodyne word describing a massive operation the Kremlin has launched to intimidate, imprison, forcibly deport, or disappear those Ukrainian citizens that Moscow decides could be a threat to its imperial ambitions to control and then annex Ukraine's territory. A recent report by the Yale Humanitarian Research Lab identified 21 filtration-related facilities in the Donetsk Oblast alone. The report identified four types of facilities, those used for registration, holding, interrogation, and long-term detention. There are also checkpoints along main thoroughfares where Ukrainian civilians fleeing from Russia-controlled areas are subjected to filtration, and cases where civilians are simply rounded up and forcibly taken to filtration facilities. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas Greenfield, noted, estimates from a variety of sources, including the Russian government, indicate that Russian authorities have interrogated, detained, forcibly deported between 900,000 and 1.6 million Ukrainian citizens from their homes to Russia, often to isolated regions in the Far East. She also said estimates are that thousands of children have been subject to filtration, some separated from their families and taken from orphanages before being put up for adoption in Russia. Why is this filtration being done, along with other measures the Kremlin is taking in the areas of Ukraine currently held by Russia's forces? The imposition of Russia's educational curriculum in schools? Attempts to get Ukrainian citizens to apply for Russian Federation passports? The reason is simple, said Ambassador Thomas Greenfield, to prepare for an attempted annexation. This effort to fabricate these facts on the ground is the predicate to sham referenda. It is part of the Russian playbook for Ukraine that we've been warning council members about since the beginning of the war. As the State Department has noted, the unlawful transfer and deportation of protected persons is a grave breach of the Fourth Geneva Convention on the Protection of Civilians and constitutes a war crime. State Department Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vidant Patel said, "We demand Russia halt its filtration operations immediately. We call on the global community to join us in condemning this practice and calling for humanitarian access to be granted."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.